is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Keith Preston. We're going to be discussing his new book, Thinkers Against Modernity. Keith, it's great having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me back, Robert.
And I'm also joined here with Alex von Goldstein.
It's great to be on with you guys, and Keith, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Keith, your book, Thinkers Against Modernity, are you coming at this from an explicitly traditionalist perspective or anti-modern perspective, or are you looking at analyzing these thinkers from like a purely like a academic basis?
I'm trying to be as value neutral as possible in this particular work. What I wanted to do was examine some of these thinkers that were critical of modernity and the values of modernity, the institutions of modernity, but I wanted to do so in a way that's relatively value neutral. I don't really heap praise on any of these thinkers in the book. Instead, I just try to dissect their ideas a bit. I try to think, look at it from the perspective of this is how they thought. These were their criticisms of modern civilization, and perhaps these are some of the ideas that we can learn from them. But I don't really see the work as an endorsement of these people as much as just sort of a perhaps partially sympathetic but largely value-neutral treatment of their work.
I know in the book you have a chapter on Julius Evola, and Evola is not someone who I would associate with you, just from like reading your work. It seems like not to be really from an Evolian perspective. So I was wondering what you think about Evola, if he has influenced you at all.
No, I'm not personally influenced by Evola at the slightest. I became interested in him largely because of my association with the alt-right. And before that, even before the alt-right was formed, I became associated for a time with people associated with things like radical traditionalism and a variety of other systems of thought that were influenced by Evola. But I don't consider Evola to be an influence on my own thinking at all. I mean, I'm not necessarily an anti-modernist personally. I am in many ways an extreme leftist. I'm heavily influenced by the intellectual tradition of the Enlightenment and then things that came after that, radical movements that emerged in the 19th and 20th century. So in many ways, many of my views are polar opposite from Evola's. But Evola is an interesting thinker in the sense that he was able to offer this critique of modernity in a way that has a certain purism to it. It's almost like he's the pure polar opposite of modernity and the values of modernity. You know, he's someone who thinks that the world has been in a state of degeneration since the 8th century BC, which is a rather interesting perspective to have. It's certainly not someone that fits into a standard intellectual paradigm. I remember years ago reading a review of Evola or an article about Evola, written by, I think it was an article in the New York Review of Books. An article from many years ago, probably the late 70s. And it was talking about how William F. Buckley, you know, even in his most conservative moments, is still light years away from being Julius Evola. That Julius Evola was sort of a Plato's Forms version of reaction. So I think that's an interesting perspective and one that I wanted to explore a bit.
Yeah, I noticed it's kind of, modernity can be kind of a vague term because different people have their own definition, and people who claim to be traditionalist or reactionaries or conservatives have a tendency to pick like one era that they see as like the pinnacle of civilization, and then everything since then has been on decline.
Yes, and for Evola, it was the 8th century B.C., for Nietzsche, it was the period of the Sophists in Greece. For Christian conservatives, it's often the Middle Ages or the Reformation if they're Protestants, or for others, it's the Roman Empire. That's a constant thread that you see among thinkers of the political right in general. I mean, even the mainstream right, they like to hark back to the 1950s, or they like to hark back to the Reagan era or something like that. So, and one of the definitive characteristics of the right, in fact, I'd argue the definitive characteristic of the political right, is that the right tends to have a far more pessimistic view of the future, and a much greater skepticism towards change. They either want to preserve some kind of status quo if they're a conservative, or they want to turn back the clock to some kind of idyllic period from the past. Again, it can be the 1950s America, it can be the time of the American Revolution, it can be the Middle Ages, Rome, ancient Greece, whatever. But that's usually a common strand of thought that you find in rightist thinking.
Isn't the other side of the right, meaning that the left is essentially, even at its like weakest point, egalitarian, and the right, even at its weakest point, is anti-egalitarian? Like the right stands for individualism from the beginning?
Well, there's about a half a dozen or so major points I think you could identify as separating the right and the left. The conflict between change and tradition is certainly one. The belief in inequality that you find on the right and the belief that equality is a primary value that you find on the left, that's certainly another value or another source of the conflict. There's also other things like particularity versus universality. The left tends to emphasize universalism of some particular type. For example, universal human rights or the universal brotherhood of humanity, whereas the right tends to be more about particular groups, some particular nation, ethnic group, social class, culture, religion, or something of that nature. Another difference is a view of human nature. The right tends to view human nature as far more fixed in terms of human beings having immutable characteristics that can't really be changed. The left will believe that human nature is far more malleable or far more shaped by social circumstances or environmental or cultural context. You know, in fact, a lot of liberals and leftists will say things like there's no such thing as human nature. It's all relative to circumstance. There's also a different view about human potential. The right tends to be more skeptical of human potential and say, look, there's only so much that human beings can do. There's only so many things that human beings can achieve. Whereas the left tends to believe more in the idea of human perfectibility, or at least they tend to have a much more optimistic view of human potential than the right. There's also an important difference in terms of the way they see history. The left tends to have a linear view of history. They see history where, in a sense of human civilization, evolving towards higher states of existence and progress and freedom and social justice or whatever, human rights, whereas the right tends to view history more from the point of view of either decline or degeneration on one hand, or they tend to have a more cyclical view of history, civilizations rise and fall. There are some rightists that perhaps are influenced by Nietzsche that might have or Heidegger that might have a more random view of history, more of a nihilist view of history. It just whatever happens, happens. And then there's, of course, a religious traditionalists might have a more providential view of history or theological view of history, but I think that's an important distinction as well.
Do you see a difference between the modern Christian left and Christian right? You know, a lot of people seem to associate Christian thinking with rightism, but, you know, if I find myself hearing a pastor on AM radio or something, it sounds leftist.
Well, yeah, in fact, I'd go further than that. I'd say that the main divisions that we see in American political culture today, the whole red tribe versus blue tribe division or left-right division, is really the equivalent of two warring sects of Christianity. Like the analogy I like to use when I explain this is the red tribe, blue tribe warfare in the United States is like the conflict between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, or if we want to use an analogy from the Islamic world, like Shia and Sunni in the Middle East, say in Iraq. On one hand, you have this red tribe that has this kind of Christianity that I won't say is a traditional form of Christianity, because a lot of the ideas that you find in that kind of Christianity or those plural types of Christianity really aren't that traditional from a historical perspective. You've got Christian Zionism, you've got Christian Reconstructionism, you've got...
Or there's like the prosperity doctrine.
Prosperity doctrine, Christian identity, a lot of stuff like that is...
Liberation theology?
I'm sorry?
Liberation theology?
Well, that's on the left.
That's
a leftist form of Christianity. But the on the traditional so-called traditional conservative right in the United States that's very Christian oriented, you have at least a belief in traditional Christian theology on some level. They really believe in God, for example. God really exists, a personal God, you know, a heavenly Father. Many of these people really believe that Jesus Christ was not only a real person, but that he really did come back from the grave and things like that. Or they really do believe the Bible is a divinely inspired, you know, almost magical book. You know, this is a common idea among rank and file conservatives with a traditionalist political outlook. But on the left in the United States, and I think in many other parts of the world as well, you do see religious leftists, by the way. For example, you mentioned liberation theology. Yeah. Liberation theology is a movement within the Catholic Church. It comes out of Latin America, but it's actually a sort of a Marxist interpretation of Christianity. You know, they interpret the stories in the Bible from the point of view of struggles for social justice. You know, the Hebrew Exodus from Egypt, you know, which is, there's no historical evidence that actually happened, but that the Bible story about the Hebrew Exodus from Egypt is one. The story of the stories about Jesus and the four Gospels, that where he talks about all this, you know, blessed are the poor, all of this kind of thing. You know, they see Jesus as sort of an original social justice warrior in many ways.
Yeah.
So you have a left-wing Christianity that really is Christian. And it's not just liberation theology. You find this kind of thinking in a lot of different forms of Christianity, including people who really take Christian theology seriously.
You make this point in your chapter on Nietzsche, and Nietzsche was ahead of his time. He obviously rejected Christianity, but he said there's like these sort of a new gods arose as these like new ideologies. In a sense, he was talking about things like a socialism, nationalism, and democracy, but that could also be kind of a precursor to how a lot of things like a political correctness has become like a secular religion.
Yeah, well, Nietzsche's idea was that what had happened in the 19th century was that as the old religious beliefs had started to fade in terms of their influence, traditional Christianity, where, you know, at least among intellectuals, ideas like deism, more liberal modernist versions of Christianity, as well as outright atheism or agnosticism, started to become more prevalent, that religious zeal was being replaced instead with zeal for more secular political ideologies like socialism or nationalism or racialism or something of that nature. And he, in fact, predicted that the 20th century, he was living in the 19th century, he believed that in the 20th century, you would see some terrible conflicts between these ideologies and their, you know, their hyper-zealous followers, which is what we saw in the world wars and things like that. But as far as the relationship between religion or between Christianity and political correctness, yeah, I see the left, the kind of left certainly that we have in the modern Western world, particularly in the United States, and I would guess in Europe as well, as a type of progressive neo-Christianity. You know, in fact, people that I know that think in that mode, I always have teased them and say, well, you're just a bunch of Christians. You're just a bunch of Bible bangers, you know. And, of course, they take offense to this because they think, you know, that the religious right is their mortal enemy. But I would say this is true even of many people on the left who have probably never seen the inside of a church. They may have never gone into a church building in their entire lives. They may have been an atheist or an agnostic their entire lives, but they still have absorbed this kind of quasi-Christian moralism that is perhaps a secularization of older forms of Christian moralism of a more overtly theological nature.
Genealogy of morals, right?
Right. To make it a little bit more simple, here's an illustration I always use. You know, I don't consider these social justice warriors or crusaders for PC to necessarily even be leftists or liberals in any historical sense or any traditionally recognizable sense. I actually see them as having more in common with theocratic conservatives or quasi-theocratic conservatives.
Mm.
That's why I think it's ridiculous when mainstream conservatives say that liberals are a moral relativist.
Oh, no, no. Modern-day PC liberals and leftists are anything but moral relativists. They are comparable to the crusaders against vice that you see among religious conservatives. You know, like when I was growing up, there was a group called the Moral Majority, and they were always crusading against, say, pornography, pornographic magazines. This is before the internet. Or they were crusading against, say, homosexuality, or, you know, dirty movies, or you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Back in the 1950s, you had do-gooders of this type crusading against comic books. In earlier times, you had guys like Anthony Comstock crusading against the dissemination of birth control information, or Carrie Nation crusading against alcohol, or you know, or a bunch of church ladies crusading against saloons and gambling dens and things like that. And I see political correctness as really being a secularized, you know, version of that. You know, these may not be people, the majority of them may not be people who take religion that seriously, or take it seriously at all. But it's still a very moralistic perspective, in the sense that they have this very rigid way of thinking about morality, and they want to impose it on everyone else. They see that is their right and their duty to impose this kind of moralism on everyone else.
I was thinking that, like, Hillary Clinton, for instance, could say she would go to war with Putin to, like, liberate LGBT people from his traditionalist oppression or something. And right, some of them would jump up and celebrate in the same way that, you know, Christian Zionists could make up some reason for supporting the Iraq war.
Sure, sure. That's a perfect example. You know, in fact, I remember having a conversation with a leftist once, a hardline PC leftist once, and we were talking about gay rights, and I was saying, well, if some people don't approve of homosexuality for whatever reason, say religion, you know, how is that any different than something else that somebody doesn't approve of? If they don't approve of smoking marijuana, they don't approve of, let's say they're a Mormon and they don't approve of drinking coffee, or they're a Jehovah's Witness and they don't approve of blood transfusion, you know. And this person actually said, well, you're being morally relative, you know, like homophobia is not just an alternative lifestyle, you know. You know, almost the mirror image of something you would hear from someone from, say, the religious right concerning homosexuality. Homosexuality is not just an alternative lifestyle. So in many ways,
well, that's like why when Paul Gottfried talks about the sacred objects, like homosexuals become a sacred object for some leftists.
Yeah, well, I the reason that I find all this so fascinating is because I was a fundamentalist Christian when I was growing up. That's the culture that I grew up in and came from, and was one that myself until I was probably in my middle teens or so. You know, and I came from the very far fringes of Christian fundamentalism. I went to a Christian Reconstructionist church. I went to a hardline private school that was a hardline Christian Zionist outlook in their theology. They were associated with Bob Jones University, you know, and all of this stuff in the evangelical subculture is even there is considered on the fringes. So that's what I once was. And years later, when I was much older, and I started coming across all of this political correctness stuff, you know, I had not subscribed to any of these Christian fundamentalist views for many years, but I started to see a lot of things that seemed very familiar, just in terms of everything from rhetoric to personality types to individual demeanor and things of that nature.
What were those circles like? Were they attached to like music scenes and things like that?
What do you mean?
These PC circles? Were you like entering into like subcultures? Like moving from the Christian fundamentalist background, did you sort of rebel and enter into sort of like punk subcultures?
Well, they didn't have a whole lot of punk where I came from. When I was in my teens, I was into heavy metal and satanic rock, and you know, I used to hang out with a lot of biker gang types and you know, druggies and people like that. But then when I became involved with radical left-wing politics, which was in the 80s, late 80s, roughly, over time I started to see this political correctness stuff within that milieu, which was my first exposure to it. And I started to realize, well, this is very familiar. I mean, the way that these people talk, the kind of mentality they have is very, very similar. So I've seen it all before. And at the time, I really didn't follow up on that. It wasn't until later when all of this political correctness stuff started becoming increasingly mainstream and working its way into mainstream institutions. Back then, it was more on the fringes.
So there was,
you know, in the 80s, for example, I never heard anybody. I was in the late 80s. I was on the far, far fringes of the left, and I never heard anybody even talk about gay marriage back then. Nowadays, political correctness is really mushroomed, if you will, and it's become something that was once on the margins and that's almost normalized now.
Was Nietzsche considered someone who has influenced a lot of the leftist philosophers and intellectuals?
My experience with the left is that the left, I don't really see Nietzsche as being a particularly important influence on the left. There are certainly some leftists that try to appropriate Nietzsche for their own purposes, and usually they give Nietzsche some sort of revisionist interpretation that's extremely shallow and often way off the mark in terms of what Nietzsche's actual views were. Yeah, in the 80s and early 90s, I knew people like that. I knew radical leftists that would talk about Nietzsche as somebody who his Superman ideas, Overman ideas, somebody who of supreme awareness and consciousness, which of course means that they thought that if he were here today, he'd be a social justice crusader or something like that, you know. But the opposite was true as well. There were always been people on the left who think of Nietzsche in terms of the Nazi appropriation of Nietzsche, which is an extreme misrepresentation of Nietzsche as well. I don't really see Nietzsche as being an influence on the left. Now, as far as the left and moral relativism, the left is kind of interesting in that regard because theoretically many leftists are moral or cultural relativists. I mean, they will say, for example, that we should never make value judgments about other cultures or at least non-European cultures because that would be racist or ethnocentric or xenophobic or imperialist or whatever. And it's really interesting how extreme that gets. I mean, they'll often go so far as to say, we shouldn't even criticize Islamic culture or strands within Islam that, you know, by any standard, oppress women and gays and other groups that the left claims to champion.
Where do you think that logic comes from? Like someone who is, far left feminist, and they defend something like Sharia law. You know, like where do you think that thinking comes from?
It comes from the same way that Christians believe they can have one God that has three personalities. It's a totally schizophrenic belief. again, as I was saying, leftists, most of them theoretically are moral relativists. They don't really believe in naturalistic ethics, or certainly not divine command ethics in a religious sense, or they will claim to reject much of the Western canon in terms of ethical philosophy. So they don't hold to religious or the kinds of metaphysical views of ethics that you find in a lot of traditional Western philosophy, but they don't really believe in natural rights and natural law and any of that kind of stuff either. You know, they tend to to the degree that they've thought about it at all, they might hold to some kind of pragmatic ethics the greatest political philosopher that the mainstream left recognizes is John Rawls. And John Rawls, his book, A Theory of Justice, that he published back in the early 70s, is really the Bible of, for social and political ethics on the center left.
You wrote about Aleister Crowley, and what's interesting about him is that he's someone who's usually kind of dismissed by traditionalists. Traditionalists will kind of caricature him as like a shallow nihilist or a debauched libertine. And I also know a lot of – there's sort of a conspiracy theory faction of the populist right also views him as like – because of this whole sort of occultist angle, they say, he's like the Illuminati. but you actually do get into his actual political ideas, and you describe him as an aristocratic radical. The core view that you put out there about him is that Aleister Crowley criticized capitalism for degrading kind of a genuine, like, a cultural elitism.
Yeah, Aleister Crowley had a lot of different dimensions to his work that are not recognized or well known or good or appreciated. Aleister Crowley, of course, is often misrepresented as having been a Satanist, which he wasn't. He had a theological system of his own that he subscribed to that was somewhat esoteric, but without getting into the details of that. As far as his political views, he was somewhat similar to what the French call an anarchist of the right. And this is someone who is very individualistic in their value system. However, they also tend to not be very egalitarian. They tend to think that individualism is best defended within a somewhat elitist social system. For example, you have a lot of proponents of in European intellectual culture, traditional European intellectual culture, that rejected modernity in favor of a type of aristocratic individualism.
Is that like J.R.R. Tolkien?
Yeah, Tolkien is an excellent example of that. That's more or less what Tolkien was. He was a type of anarchist of the right. Yeah, and now in his actual political views, he was a monarchist. But he once described himself as an anarchist. But what he meant by that is somebody that favors individualism against egalitarianism on one hand and against the passions of the mob on the other hand.
It's like Hans Hermann Hoppe, you would say, similar to that?
Hans Hermann Hoppe is within this tradition as well. And there's a lot of thinkers like this from the European right. Tolkien is one example. Salvador Dali was an example of this. Hans Hermann Hoppe is an example. Erich von Kunert-Lodin, Bertrand de Jouvenel, Jose Ortega y Gasset. There's a lot of Crowley. Aleister Crowley, I think, fits into that tradition as well. A type of, or in American culture, H.L. Mencken would be a perfect representation of this point of view. Mencken himself was an elitist. He admired the Second Reich of Kaiser Wilhelm, but he had the kind of an anarchistic attitude, sort of an aristocratic individualism that viewed common people and common culture as a herd that's out to bring down the superior man or the free-thinking individual. He thought that a lot of these thinkers criticized modern mass democracy because they believed that modern mass democracy had the impact of leveling everything to the point where the free-thinking individual was susceptible to the passions of the mob and mob rule. And this kind of thinker believes that the free-thinking individual, the creative artist, you know, the dissident writer, etc., is better protected under a kind of aristocratic society with a certain sense of a certain amount of social stratification than they are under a system of mob rule or what they perceive to be mob rule.
Not exactly like a traditional aristocracy, but kind of creating a new aristocracy of sort of like the top intellectuals and artists and creative types. You could kind of make that case about a capitalism. You sort of get to that with a Crowley, but with a capitalism, like the people who profit the most create the most lowbrow culture. Often a lot of the greatest writers, intellectuals, and artists are broke. Did Crowley ever make that point himself?
Well, Crowley's critique of modern civilization was in that vein. That's another issue, is that a lot of thinkers with this kind of perspective viewed modern capitalist democracy as antithetical to the creation and maintenance of high culture. They believe that capitalism is a system where you allow the merchant class to rule, basically. The merchant class cares nothing about the creation of culture of any authentic or any kind of, certainly not of any kind of highbrow nature. They only care about what they can sell. So that means they're only going to create the kind of culture they can sell to the masses who aren't going to appreciate high culture. They're not going to listen to classical music and read sophisticated literary works and things of that nature. You know, they're going to watch reality TV. So that's this kind of cultural critique that you see among anti-modernist thinkers is very much in that vein. And Crowley, I think, was in that genre as well, as was Mencken and some of the other people I was just referencing.
And you also talk about democracy versus liberalism in your chapter on Carl Schmitt. There is this sort of perception that democracy and liberalism complement each other as a quintessential traits, when actually Schmitt made the case that classical liberalism is based on the individual and mass democracy is basically the rule of the majority, and that supersedes the rights of the individual.
Right. Well, there's always been a tendency to confuse liberalism and democracy, and that's what Schmitt was getting at. Schmitt was one of the thinkers that really forcefully addressed this question and said that liberalism and democracy are not the same thing. What's interesting is that liberalism and democracy did arise at the same time in Western political philosophy. For example, the godfather of modern liberalism was John Locke, and John Locke, for his time, was something of a bourgeois individualist, I guess, is what the Marxists would call him. He was somebody that believed in religious toleration, at least among the different Protestant sects. He was in favor of property rights. You know, the function of government is to protect property rights of the merchant class and the landholding class and things of that nature. So this is sort of a forerunner to the idea that of liberalism as the protector of individual rights and liberties and things of that nature. Now, democracy arises during the same Enlightenment period, and it's you know, forefathers were thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau who championed the idea of poverty, popular sovereignty, the general will. Mass democracy thing of so that nature. And what happened when modern states were created through the American Revolution and the French Revolution and some of these other revolutions, what you really see coming into place is sort of a hybrid of democracy and liberalism, where on one hand, there's this liberal dimension to some of these kinds of states, like the American constitutional system is a good example. The Declaration of Independence is just a rewrite of Locke's work for the most part. And if you look at the provisions of the Declaration of the U.S. Constitution, rather, you see the Bill of Rights with these individual rights spelled out and procedural rights for the accused and things like that. You know, that's liberalism. That's within the tradition of English liberalism. And then you see the in the Articles of the Constitution, you see the different branches of government and separation of powers and all that. That's a borrowing from different thinkers of the Enlightenment as well, like Montesquieu and some others, and which in turn they were heavily influenced by the Roman Republic, if you want to go back far enough. But you also see ideas like popular sovereignty working its way into the American system, and particularly the French system. You start to see that. You start to see this idea of popular sovereignty, one man, one vote, popular rule, vox populi, as it's sometimes called. And there's a certain tension between those two things.
There's also kind of the case that Carl Schmitt was sort of the father of the realist school of thought. And Schmitt made the case that the U.S. foreign policy outlook was ideologically driven rather than pragmatically driven. And in that chapter, you sort of go on to talk about a U.S. foreign policy like the dominant strains of a neoconservatism and like liberal interventionism as opposed to the sort of realist or pragmatist foreign policy.
Well, Schmitt wasn't the founder of the realist school of foreign policy. He lived in the early 20th century, at least that's when he was writing about this. And the realist tradition, and I guess you could say realists are, go back to the tradition of Hobbes and Machiavelli. I mean, Hobbes and Machiavelli are really the the first modern realists, I guess. And then all through the, you know, see in the 19th century, you see thinkers like Clausewitz or Metternich and some others, and those are certainly some early realists. But Schmitt was in that tradition. The realist approach to foreign policy is essentially a kind of pragmatic one. You know, what are the interests of the state or the nation or whatever? It's very much just about conflicting interests. You know, how do we advance our own interest in a world of brawling nations? Basically, it's not something that's idealistic. It's not something that's about, you know, we have this ideology, this set of morals and values and philosophical beliefs.
Both neoconservatism and a liberal interventionist internationalist foreign policy are, would you say they're ideologically driven, or they have other factors, practical factors as well?
Well, I mean, those kinds of factors are always present. I mean, you know, people who seek power or who have economic interest attached to some particular action or whatever are always going to come up with some kind of rationale for it. So, yeah, I mean, the neoconservatives and the liberal internationalists are certainly aligned with the American plutocratic class and the American military-industrial complex and the American empire and ambitious individual politicians and the national security establishment, the Pentagon top brass and defense contractors and all of that. So, yeah, there's all these kinds of vested interests in it that are just about money and power. But in terms of the ideological rationale or apparatus behind this, liberal internationalism is an outgrowth of Wilsonian views. The idea of a war to end all wars or making the world safe for democracy, collective security. Liberal internationalists basically believe in foreign military interventionism, working through international institutions like the United Nations and international alliances like NATO, for the sake of, in their minds at least, promoting world peace or advancing human rights and things like that. You know, which often seems to remarkably correspond to the interest of, say, American oil interests or the interest of the Israel lobby or whatever, but that's a somewhat separate question.
Well, this goes back to what we talked about on a previous show. Every power structure needs an ideology to justify its power. And
sure.
The problem with realism is that a government based on realism without an explicit ideology is not going to be able to exploit that ideology is effectively to control the masses?
Yeah, well, there are states around the world that essentially have a realist foreign policy.
Would you say Russia?
Yeah, Russia, I think, pretty much has a realist foreign policy, and I'd say China has a realist foreign policy. Russia's foreign policy today is pretty much a traditional Russian foreign policy of the kind that's existed, of the kind they had during the Tsarist period. And Russia sees their legitimate sphere of influence as being Central Asia and Eastern Europe. You know, they've always viewed Central Asia as a necessary buffer zone between themselves and the Muslims. They've always viewed Eastern Europe as a necessary buffer zone between themselves and Western Europe, which has been the historic invasion route into Russia. I mean, Russia's been invaded countless times from Western Europe. Their approach to foreign policy in that respect is not much different than the American Monroe Doctrine from the 19th century. And China's the same way. China sees their legitimate sphere of interest as being in the South China Seas and in East Asia and all of that. Neither one of those states have this belief in some sort of universalist ideology that they have to have some sort of messianic zeal for and spread throughout the world. However, the major factions of the American foreign policy establishment do have an ideology of that type. Liberal internationalism is the dominant one. The neoconservatives are their closest rivals, and the neoconservatives are really just a more extreme version of liberal internationalism. They have this really, really fanatical belief in American exceptionalism, and they believe that America's, you know, so good that America doesn't need to be bothered with consulting allies or going through international institutions in the same way that the liberal internationalists are. You know, they're a lot more zealous for American unilateral military interventions. You know, they have this idea that the American empire practices a type of benevolent hegemony for the good of the world.
Could you see this this idea of like American exceptionalism developing on the left now? Like when Hillary Clinton, that guy, what was his name, Khan, whose son had been killed in 2003, when he held up the Constitution at the DNC, everyone was like clapping. But, you know, these are people who really, a lot of them don't like the Constitution, and they want to, you know, move beyond that idea. You don't really see a lot of people on the right with that idea. Maybe people on the alt-right are thinking they want to move beyond the Constitution. But it was that this guy was holding up the Constitution, and they were all clapping. It was like for the symbol of what America could be for them.
I see with like a mainstream conservatives, they advocate a form of American exceptionalism based on kind of a liberal internationalist values.
Well, there's a number of points we could get to with this. In fact, it goes back to the point that I didn't really follow up on earlier, where Alex asked me about why is it that the left will champion Islam on one hand and feminism on the other hand, and why do they have this moralistic zealotry when they're theoretically moral relativists, you know? And I would agree that modern leftist ideology is a kind of schizophrenic mess. I mean, most leftists implicitly are moral relativists. You know, they don't believe in the traditional concepts that define moral objectivity. They're technically moral subjectivists for the most part, but they don't really practice that. They replace it with a political ideology that serves as a de facto religion, where they have this belief in equality and human rights and things like that. And that becomes an almost quasi-theological belief, you know, where it's something that's beyond question. You know, telling one of these people that you don't believe in equality is like telling a Christian fundamentalist that you don't believe in God. You know, it's just that they're not hearing it. You know, it's beyond the realm of what they are willing to entertain in terms of possibilities.
You wrote a chapter about distributism, about Chesterton and Belloc, and basically kind of the distributist movement came about as a kind of reaction to the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century, but their core kind of principle is that the flaw of a capitalism is that there are too few capitalists to have as many people owning their own businesses as possible. Can you talk about distributism and how it is different than a capitalism, but also a Marxist thought?
Yeah, distributism was a philosophy that believed that on one hand, it was bad to have the kinds of concentration of wealth and control over property that you saw in early industrial capitalism in the late 19th and early 20th century. But Belloc and Chesterton were not, were conservatives. They were traditional conservatives, Catholic conservatives, traditionalists, and they didn't advocate socialism or certainly didn't advocate a Marxist revolution. They didn't advocate the idea of centralizing wealth and property into the hands of the state in the name of the people or trying to have a planned economy or something like that. Instead, they wanted to go in the other direction. They wanted to distribute wealth and property as far as possible directly to the individual and families and all of that. So they wanted to have essentially what amounted to a society of small capitalists, lots of small capitalists. And they thought that as far as the large industrial corporations and things like that, perhaps some of the problems with those could be dealt with by resurrecting the medieval guilds, and that the guilds perhaps could become the basis of industrial organization. It's very similar to guild socialism. It's very similar to other ideas you find on the left, like syndicalism or like council communism and things like that. But that's roughly the distributist vision. It's a decentralized economy with lots of small property holders on one hand, kind of like individualist anarchism or Benjamin Tucker or something like that, but with large industries under some kind of worker management system or worker capitalist partnership, you know, what they call co-determination in Europe, or like guild socialism or syndicalism or something.
That seems like that would be the economic system for something like aristocratic individualism.
Yeah, well, there were many people who subscribed to this radical aristocratic individualism that had these kinds of views. Distributism became popular among intellectuals with this kind of outlook. Crowley himself, Aleister Crowley, actually had economic views fairly similar to this as well. And the idea was, depending on the individual's motivation, the individual thinker, the idea was they wanted to eliminate the rule of big money in society. They wanted, some were concerned about the impact this had on the workers, you know, like the socialists were. Others were more concerned about the impact it had on traditional culture and traditional values, organic local communities and the local parish and family values and things like that. That was largely Chesterton and Belloc's concern. You had others that were concerned about what they saw as the dehumanizing aspects of bourgeois society or capitalist commercial society, or the vulgarity, what they saw as the vulgarity of capitalist commercial society, or the lack of individuality that they perceived in mass society. This is the time when the idea of the mass man starts to develop, and all of these different systems of thought these kinds of things might be some kind of alternative.
Is this related to something like Desbanois talks about, the transition of Homo sapien to Homo economicus? Is the mass man related to that?
Yeah, well, this is a critique that a lot of anti-modernist thinkers have of both classical liberalism and Marxism. They will argue that classical liberalism and the economic system that's associated with it, which is capitalism, and Marxism both see people, human beings and human society, solely in economic terms. And that's what they mean by homo economicus. Everything is just about economics. According to this view, what's wrong with capitalism is that capitalism is just about whatever will make money. And the Marxists are accused of essentially standing that on its head and saying, well, it's not whatever makes the capitalist money that matters. It's the material interest of the working class. And these kinds of thinkers would criticize both of these perspectives, saying, well, what about spiritual values? And they, if they were religious, they may mean spiritual values in a literal religious sense, or in the wider concept of the human spirit, you know, or what about culture, or what about art and literature, you know, or what about ethics, or what about
thumos or something like that?
Yeah, what about human nobility, you know, that kind of thing. You know, they would say that both capitalism and Marxism are just about consumption. Marxism is just about making sure the workers get fed and all of that. Capitalism is just about making sure that the merchants turn a profit. And they anti-modernist thinkers see these philosophies as dehumanizing. They think that it's reducing human beings down to an animalistic state where all they're going to do is eat and sleep and shit, and that's about it. You know, they see this as undermining the nobility of the human animal, they see it as a degeneration of human culture.
You wrote an entire chapter about the European New Right, including Alain Desbanois. Can you talk about sort of the origins of the New Right and where the movement is sort of headed today?
Well, it's interesting because I don't hear a lot of people talking about the origins of the New Right, which are actually quite interesting. Like with this alt-right movement that's developed now, that's, you know, partially influenced by the European New Right as well as other things. But the European New Right was actually founded back in the late 1960s as a counterpart to the New Left. But what the founders of the European New Right wanted to do was they wanted to fuse the New Left with some of the insights of the conservative revolutionaries that existed during the interwar period between World War I and World War II in the Weimar Republic and Germany and Italy and fascist Italy and some other European nations. You had what was called the conservative revolution. And these were thinkers that were not necessarily fascists and certainly not Nazis, but these were people like Ernst Junger, like Edgar Jung, like Arthur Moeller Vandenbroek in Germany, or like Ernst Nakisch, the National Bolshevik in Germany, and also the Italian elite theorists like Pareto and Michels and Mosca and Sorrell and some of these. All of these thinkers are part of this wider thing that was called the conservative revolution. This was sort of a range of thinkers or intellectual currents that developed that were anti-modernist, but they weren't reactionary. They weren't thrown in altar traditionalists. They weren't about going back to king and church and aristocracy. And they weren't conservative either. They weren't about trying to just preserve bourgeois society as it was or whatever. That's not their motivation. Instead, they were concerned about the loss of aristocratic values in a more of a Nietzschean sense, in the sense of the superior man that rises above the herd mentality or the herd psychology or the creative person that's being submerged by mindless conformity of the masses, or high culture that's being dragged down by vulgar commercial culture or plebeian culture. And some of the New European New Right wanted to take some of the ideas of these conservative revolutionary thinkers and actually fuse them with some of the ideas of the New Left, like the New Left's interest in moving beyond both Sovietism on one hand and Americanism on the other hand, and the New Left's critique of American imperialism or the impact of Americanization on culture, on European culture and world cultures. And the New Left was also interested in things like environmentalism and some of these kinds of things. So that's really the origins of the European New Right. It's sort of a hybrid of the New Left and the conservative revolution.
You made that point in your essay that they did try to appeal to the left, and there is kind of a lot of overlap with the dissident left on things like opposition to globalization, American imperialism, anti-consumerism, environmentalism. I've noticed you see that more with a lot of these new right thinkers like Alain de Benoist, but do you see that to the same degree with the alt-right, or you think the alt-right is in some ways moving closer to like a mainline American conservatism, or more like the American style, like white nationalist movement?
I see the American alt-right as being somewhat different from the European New Right, in that the European New Right is more about a type of cultural nationalism, more than a racial nationalism. Now, there are certainly people in the European New Right that are racial nationalists. And there have actually people who were in the European New Right who've broken with it because they thought it wasn't racial nationalism.
Didn't de Benoist leave because it was becoming racialist?
Yeah, and there were some splits there. First, Guillaume Fay left initially because it wasn't racialist enough.
What's interesting about Fay is his foreign policy outlook is different. There's a faction of the European New Right that advocates an alliance with the Third World and even the Islamic world as an ally against American imperialism. But Guillaume Fay sees the main threat to the West as being from the Islamic world and a Third World in general. So there is some disagreements on a foreign policy outlook.
Yeah, that's an important difference as well. And that's a major issue for Europeans. As for the American alt-right, the way I've seen the American alt-right emerge and develop in the last, say, 6 years or so since it started getting going was, I think it's over time it's moved more and more towards American-style white nationalism. I think it more and more resembles, say, the kind of white nationalism that you saw in the 1920s with thinkers like Lothrop Stoddard or Madison Grant. If you look at the common threads that you see among all the different factions of the alt-right and overlapping tendencies, and there's a lot of them, and a wide range of views, and there's a lot of disagreement about a lot of stuff. But I'd say that this belief in race realism, for example, is probably one of the most important ideas, the most common ideas that you find on the alt-right. Also, a rejection of feminism. I think, you know, the race realists and the MRAs and Manosphere and all that have started to overlap quite a bit as well. A belief in HVD, you know, the IQ realism, IQ determinism, all of these kinds of ideas that like that seem to me to be the dominant set of ideas or the most prevalent or popular set of ideas on the alt-right, which have their roots in American-style white nationalism, you know, as opposed to, say, the European New Right critique of American imperialism or as opposed to libertarianism and
Keith,
their opposition to the government. Yes.
Do you think the reason why that is, why the European New Right is rooted in more like ideology and the American New Right is basically white nationalist, is that because like America has had no true right? They have, you know, like how like, these other, like, you know, there would be a monarchy in European countries. There was a sense of like a right and like tradition. And it seems that America has sort of lacked that.
Yeah.
Like a true right,
in,
per se.
In Europe, I think cultural nationalism is a much more viable concept because you have all these different cultures, these different nations in Europe with these distinctive cultures and languages and histories and things like that. They go back long before anybody even knew the North American continent even existed. So I think a kind of cultural nationalism is certainly more viable for Europeans. America, like you said, has never really had a right. I mean, there's never been. I mean, the American Revolution was a classical liberal bourgeois class revolution against the British monarchy, against the Church of England, against the hereditary British aristocracy. You know, it was a rebellion by what was, by European standards at the time, a middle class or gentry class against the elite. And you know, the American founding documents are straightforward classical liberal documents. And the idea of having a right wing in a nation like that is a bit of a reach. Now, you could say Southern nationalism is perhaps more closer to a European right. But, you know, the American right has never been about anything other than preserving capitalism, basically. I mean, even in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, the American right was always about resisting the encroachments or supposed encroachments of the labor movement or socialism or progressivism.
But weren't people like Madison Grant concerned with preserving the environment, though? Wasn't there a sort of anti-capitalist, naturalist bent in the early 20th century?
Also, Jack London's a good example of that.
Yeah, well, Jack London was a socialist, but he was also something of a racialist. You can be a leftist, by the way, and be a racialist. Not all leftists are anti-racists. In fact, anti-racism really wasn't that prominent an idea on the left, I would say, not until the post-war period, the post-World War II period. But someone like Madison Grant, though, was actually a progressive for his time. And that's another thing, too, about this left-right distinction is that during the early 20th century, being a white nationalist was considered progressive. Being a conservationist, or what we would today call an environmentalist, was considered progressive.
Well, couldn't you make a comparison between the two issues, even if you look at it on purely aesthetic grounds, say that you're preserving a distinct ethnic group, or you're preserving like a endangered species or wilderness area on the grounds that you want to preserve those distinct aesthetic qualities from changes that are being brought about by, say, commerce and capitalism?
Oh, yeah, I'd say they're identical. In fact, I've raised this issue with leftists in the past. I will say, well, you know, what do you folks really have against white nationalists? Right? You folks want to preserve endangered species of every conceivable type, you know, snails and birds and all sorts of things. And not just on practical grounds, like there, you know, the environmentalism that you see on the left is not just a practical environmentalism. It's not just about, you know, we need to have clean air and clean drinking water and things like that. You know, they see nature as an end unto itself. It's almost like a kind of nature worship, like a nature religion or something. And they, you know, at the bare minimum, they want to preserve, say, endangered species on aesthetic grounds, which is, you know, very similar to ethnic preservationism. And it's not just, you know, white nationalists who are into ethnic preservationism. You find that kind of strand of thinking in all ethnic groups.
Well, and it seems that a leftist issue with or a modern liberal issue with people who are white nationalists is that a lot of their thinking, I could kind of call it anti-whitism. You know, where what they can say free Tibet, but the same argument that, you know, some sort of Southern nationalist would make is the same argument that I think a Tibetan would make, that his people were being overcrowded by other people and he couldn't lead his traditional lifestyle.
At the same time, there are also communists who, American communists who actually support China's occupation of Tibet, like Michael Parenti, for example, is a prominent American Marxist who is anti-Tibetan on grounds that they're a reactionary, feudal, religious culture, you know, as opposed to the Marxist, supposedly Marxist Chinese. In fact, he defended the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and on the same grounds. But it's interesting how if you look at the ideas about race that the left had back in the early 20th century, you see a type of about face. In the post-World War II era, like it's in the post-World War II era that the left really develops anti-racism as a primary area of interest. You don't see much concern about that in the early 20th century. In fact, the Socialist Party, the old Socialist Party of Eugene Debs, was not particularly concerned about racism in the American South. The IWW was radical for its time because they would actually organize black workers and things like that. Even the old Communist Party had this idea of a separate black homeland in the American South eventually. So the idea that, you know, racism is a primary area of concern and the idea that you see on the left today of sees a struggle not so much in terms of workers versus capitalists as much as it's people of color versus hegemonic privileged whites, you know, that idea is something that emerges in the post-war era. Then that starts to get rolling in the 1960s when that becomes a prominent idea.
There's an argument put out by the new right, and I guess the alt-right as well, that things like anti-racism, political correctness, mass immigration, and feminism are products of capitalism?
Yeah, and I think a solid case can be made for that in the sense that, in fact, Noam Chomsky has made this argument. Noam Chomsky is, you know, the leading leftist intellectual probably in the world, and he argues that capitalism ultimately is anti-racist because with capitalism, you have to constantly expand into new markets, and you're always looking for new markets and new groups of people to sell things to, and new sources of labor and things of that nature. And it's interesting what today to me when I hear leftists talking about, you know, we're struggling against capitalism, racism, sexism, as if, you know, these things are somehow antithetical. Capitalism. American-style capitalism is not about trying to resurrect Jim Crow or something like that. They're about trying to sell things to black consumers
people are totally interchangeable to them.
Yeah, exactly.
They're just whoever they can make a profit off of. I mean, I feel like you see this where, you can look at commercials for, you know, major corporations or whatever, and they're selling products but kind of giving them like an LGBT feeling, or it will try to be as Afrocentric as possible in order to seem progressive, but they're really just pandering to like a new market of people who think like that, or, you know, for whatever reason. Sure.
What are your thoughts on Guillaume Fay's concept of RKO futurism as opposed to kind of a reactionary traditionalism?
Well, the idea behind that is it's a somewhat apocalyptic philosophy. It basically argues that the modern world is doomed, it's going to collapse, and out of that he's hoping a new kind of European aristocracy will arise a new kind of elite, not necessarily a traditional elite, but a new kind of elite. And he sees that as sort of a resulting in a two-tier system. You know, he has this idea that perhaps technology and the benefits of modernity and all of that will be available to elites, but not necessarily to the masses, or certainly not to the what we now call the underdeveloped countries. You know, so very much a two-tier world, two-tier society. The issue that I see with his views on that is I think some of it, for example, I think some of it is too apocalyptic. I think it depends too much on this idea of some total collapse of civilization, which, you know, is by no means a given. While it purports to be a futuristic philosophy, maybe it is in the sense of embracing technology on a certain level and things of that nature. It's not a roll back the clock. You know, it's not a type of Luddism or romantic medievalism. But in some ways, it would be a kind of restoration of feudalism in the sense of, you know, the very rigid, stratified system of social classes, maybe not the kind of social classes you find under capitalism, but more like feudalism, where it's more you have a scribe status and then it's more static. It's not a philosophy that I'm particularly impressed with. I think it's interesting, but it strikes me as on one hand too apocalyptic and almost science fiction like, and on the other hand it's too reactionary.
Well, there is a kind of a futurist strain of the right, I guess, if you want to use kind of the word rights and right in quotes. I don't know if a lot of these people would describe themselves as right wing, but going back to, like, say, Italian futurism, to even people within, like, factions of a neo-reaction that are futurist.
The right wing is not necessarily reactionary in the sense of wanting to go back to previous states of existence in terms of technological or economic development. They may think that civilization itself is dying out, and they may envision some kind of new civilization, but not necessarily one that where all of that is going away, where there's, you know, there's no longer airplanes or, you know, rocket ships or anything like that. In fact, I know people who are on the alt-right, including well-known people on the alt-right, who are really into the idea of eventual space colonization if European civilization becomes overrun, say, by mass immigration, then we'll just have European civilizations that are reconstituted on other planets.
Well, I remember Richard Spencer said something a couple of years ago. They were like, well, where would this ethnostate be? And then he said, like, on the moon.
Yeah, and he's really into that. He's actually really into that. I've heard him make comments like that quite a few times. But, I mean, that's not uncommon, though, among people on the alt-right, and it wasn't uncommon among earlier branches of the right, of that kind of right, of the kind of revolutionary right.
Keith Preston, we are out of time. Is there anything else you'd like to add about the book, Thinkers Against Modernity, before we wrap things up?
Well, for people who are interested in the book, you can get the book from our website. If you just go to attackthesystem.com, you'll see the book displayed on the website, and that'll provide you with a link where you can order the book.
Keith, thanks for being on, and also thanks, Alex.